So can you hear me in the back? I hope yes. So today I'm going to talk about our recent progress to simulate core collapse supernovae in long term. Long term means from the shock revival to the shock breakout and beyond. And this is a collaboration with Ewald Müller, Thomas Janka, and also Viktor Trobin at ITEP in Moscow. So I don't want to comment so much on the viability of the neutrino-driven mechanism, but I think it's a bit too early to, it's much too early to conclude that the neutrino-driven mechanism will fail to produce the desired energy for the explosion, mainly because we have so many uncertainties that we need to put in our explosion models. So we have hydrodynamics, GR, nuclear equation of state, neutrino physics, and another important uncertainty is the Poincaré condition that we have to put in our models. So as we don't yet know how the explosion mechanism of core collapse works, we hope to learn more from what we can observe after the explosion. Neutrinos, gravitational waves will provide direct information of the condition in the supernova core. And in the remnants, we can maybe infer the explosion energy to constrain the progenitor. We have the explosion asymmetries, the pulsar kicks, the nucleosynthesis yields, the light curve and spectra. So we from what we can observe to learn more about the explosion mechanism. So our approach, the current approach, is that we start from the 1D stellar evolution model. We evolve them through core collapse and core bounce in 1D, and then at about 15 milliseconds after the core bounce, we map it to a 3D code. And then we do a parametric study of the explosion. We prescribe the neutrino luminosity and energy from the proton-neutron star core, and we tune that to get the desired explosion properties. We run the explosion until the nearly the saturation of the explosion energy, about 1.3 seconds afterward. And after that, we shut down the neutrino. We evolve them until the shock breakout for red supergiant stars that happen around a day, depending on the explosion energy. And then at that time, we map again to 1D, and then Viktor Trobin took over to calculate the light curve to compare with observations. So right now we have quite a number of models. This is the list as of 2013, and the list is growing. I have something like maybe 10 more models, and right in this table we have four different progenitors, the W and L. 15 are red supergiant stars, 15 solar mass, and this is these two are blue supergiant stars for comparison with 87A. Well, some of these models are already calculated beyond the shock breakout, these models in the red boxes here. And we studied the neutron star kick mechanism by, we call it the gravitational tugboat mechanism. And this model, W15, red supergiant star, this model produces the highest kick velocity in our set of models. So in the end, it gives about 700 kilometers per second for the recoil velocity. And in this movie, you will Yeah, the surface in the white surface in the center is the proton neutron star, and you will see the shock in green. And now we get the neutrino-driven convection. You will see that the explosion happens more strongly in the lower left direction. And inside, we'll see asymmetries in the ejecta, mainly to the upper right. So opposite to the direction that the explosion is stronger. And we'll see that kick direction is along this asymmetries, these dense clumps in the ejecta. So what happens is that these dense clumps, the red stuffs before, they drag the neutron star by gravity, and that will keep growing. So as a result, because the explosion is stronger in one direction, you produce more heavy elements, for example, nickel, in the hemisphere opposite to the kick direction. So this color shows the nickel mass at 315 milliseconds and 515, and so this is the nickel is formed in the shock heated layer. Because the shock is stronger, so the temperature is higher, more nickel is produced. So do we observe this in the in the supernova remnant phase? So if this is observed, I think it's an indication that this is the kick is produced by the tugboat mechanism. So that's one thing to keep in mind. These figures show the morphology at the shock breakout time, the morphology of the heavy elements in the ejecta. Well, we choose to show this nickel-rich ejecta because they trace the asymmetries that were created during the explosion itself. These are the surface of constant nickel mass fraction colored by the radial velocity. So the red stuffs are the fast nickel. The blue stuffs are the slow ones. Among these four progenitors, we can divide the morphology into three types. So in this red supergiant stars, we see a bunch of concentration of Rayleigh-Taylor fingers in few directions, so 1, 2, 3, 4, roughly. In this 20 solar mass model, we see a more spherical structure, and in this B15 model, a blue supergiant, we see a spherical structure inside and elongated Rayleigh-Taylor fingers on top. So do we understand what's going on? What determines what type of morphology that we get at the shock breakout time? So we have to understand first the shock dynamics, and that is quite simple. In the when the shock propagates inside the star, it follows the Seydoff solution after the explosion energy has saturated. So whenever this profile rho r cubed inside the star is increasing, you'll get a deceleration of the shock, and if that decreases, so the dotted line here, you get the shock acceleration. And this non-monotonic dynamics of the shock give rise to the Rayleigh-Taylor unstable layers at the composition interfaces. For this red supergiant models, if we look at the nickel ejecta, we'll see that as the shock expands, accelerates strongly at the helium and hydrogen interface, the trailing nickel-rich ejecta they will eventually collide with the reverse shock, which is formed much further ahead because the shock, the forward shock is accelerating quite strongly because of the steep density gradient here. So you will see this compression effect of the nickel-rich ejector at the tips of these elongated fingers. So after the nickel ejector collides with the reverse shock, then another round of Rayleigh-Taylor instabilities grow again, and that gives you these tiny fingers in this three or four directions, depending on the early asymmetry. But in this N20 model, blue supergiant, we saw nearly no Rayleigh-Taylor at the early phase. So the morphology at around 60 seconds after the explosion and 1,000 seconds, they stay mainly the same. And they are slow because the nickel is not mixed yet to the high velocity part in the ejector. And as a result, again, the reverse shock will form when the main shock enters the hydrogen envelope. This structure of nickel collide with the reverse shock and they are compressed. And yeah, because the shock accelerates only a little at the helium-hydrogen interface, there is no time for these bubbles to stretch. So the structure is more spherical. But for this case, we see a strong growth of Rayleigh-Taylor. So this nickel are already mixed to high velocity, indicated by this dashed blue line here. The red curve is the velocity of the shock. So these fingers are nearly traveling at the same speed as the forward, the average shock speed. And as a result, some of these fingers survive the reverse shock that will form later at the helium-hydrogen interface. You can see the reverse shock by the color discontinuity here. And after that, the fingers, they grow. The part that is trapped by the reverse shock are forming the spherical inner part of the ejector. So we understand how the morphology, the three different types of morphology at the shock breakout. Interesting to see, to compare the early and the late time morphology. In these three cases, we see quite a strong correlation between the early time. This is only 3 seconds after the explosion and the morphology at the day after the explosion. But in this case, we don't see a strong correlation. Mainly because the asymmetry was washed away by the reverse shock. Oops. Yeah, and we also did a bunch of models to calculate the light curve to compare with the supernova 1987A, and this is the result. So one of our model, the B15 model, this model with the elongated fingers, we can produce a nice and smooth rise of the light curve, and fit roughly with this part of the light curve of 87A, but we are still lacking fits for the early and late part, and that's connected to the progenitor structure. So we can say that none of these stars are progenitor for 87A. So the conclusion is that we studied the kick mechanism by gravitational tugboat mechanism, and we believe that can explain the observed average velocity of the pulsars that we see in the high kick cases, we see hemispheric asymmetries of the heavy elements. So do we observe that in the remnant phase? And yeah, the evolution of asymmetries as the shock propagates through the star, how that evolves connects to the density structure of the progenitor star. So we can somehow study the structure of the progenitor by looking at the asymmetries. And just 1 minute. We have now also extended the simulation beyond 1 day. So Michael Gabler at MBA continues the simulation up to a few months or already years after the explosion. And yeah, we are working with Victor Tobin for other models for other supernova other than 87A. So my final conclusion is that we are living in an exciting time. We are beginning to compare, connect the supernova explosion models to supernova remnants. Thank you.
All right, we have some time for questions. Dan?
Anup, it's fantastic that you're going to be on this direction towards connecting supernovae and supernova remnants. You showed this exciting work of explosions taking place in different progenitor stars. Mm-hmm. I'm asking about the models that you're using to what progenitor stars that you're using. I think they're probably the typical Woosley and Weaver ones, 1D evolved, made 10, 20 years ago. I just wonder, in light of growing evidence that stars can undergo instabilities towards the end of their lives and perturb what would be a 1D evolved progenitor structure, if there's any influence that you would see that potentially affecting this, and or is there work towards incorporating that in the future?
I didn't get the point. Can you repeat again?
Just basically, I see here you're showing the models, Woosley and Weaver, 95,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's 1D evolved.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We now see evidence that stars are being perturbed.
You mean the asymmetry is prior to core collapse.
That's it. I guess the bottom line is, are there efforts to improve these models? Because the 95 models are typically used, but you know, we're in 2016 now.
Yeah, so this is a message to stellar evolution people. I mean, yeah, there has been some evidences that the asymmetries prior to collapse will make your models explode easier, maybe, and that will, I think, certainly influence the asymmetries that you create during the explosion and after the explosion. So, yeah, we have not yet any idea how that work, and yeah, at the moment we only have 1D stellar evolution model. We don't have 3D collapse model yet.
Sorry, just to your knowledge, do you know if they're working on this?
There are people working on 3D stellar evolution model, like Annette and Mekin and Kausch, John Kausch. But there are not so many available. There are no available model for the supernova community yet.
Yeah. Thank you.
Very quick follow-up for Danny. I mean, no, they work on this, but the codes are so different that it's difficult to make them. I know Fritz Röpke's group is also working on this, so there's someone in Germany that you might be able to contact. But I know it's a difficult process, and so I guess the models will take much longer to do.
Okay, let's thank our speaker again.